My name is David Duncan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, David.
Hey, everybody. Thank you, Sam, so much for asking me to come and speak. It's always good to be back up here in Madison with you guys. Thank all of you guys for showing up today. That's a big crowd you got here tonight. And, you know, I'm glad you guys are here because I had this sponsor that when he finally got a hold of me, he straightened me out on a couple of things. Unsolicited, he looked at me and said, Dave, you need to understand something. He said, you need to understand that you need AA a lot more than AA needs you. Because I was wondering. And he could tell. Sponsors can just tell stuff like that, you know. And I understand that today, you know, because if something had happened, we got caught up in traffic, or, you know, they got in an accident, God forbid, got an accident or something happened, I couldn't make it today. There's a whole room full of people here, any one of which could get up to the podium tonight and tell their story, you know, and y'all would have an AA meeting, you know, but I'd feel pretty silly driving all the way out here to Madison and talk to an empty room. So I appreciate you guys being here and helping me get a meeting tonight. It's an honor and privilege to get asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all are a very polite group. They asked me before the meeting if I was okay with being recorded. I appreciate you asking me that, because they don't always ask you that when you go places. No, they don't ask you always. But I think that's an important service that you guys do, making those speaker tapes available. I'm a big fan of speaker tapes. I was kind of raised in AA on speakers meetings, mostly, I think, because my sponsor wanted me to shut up. So he took me to a lot of speakers meetings. And you know, at one point when I was 3 years sober, I went overseas and lived in Ecuador, South America for a year and a half. And before I went, my sponsor said, right, your grand sponsor, who at the time ran this little thing called B&R Tapes, he's one of the tapers out of Tifton, Georgia, and he said, right, your grand sponsor, send him a check for $48 and tell him you want to be at the Tape of the Month Club. And I said, okay. And I just gave him $48, and every month he would send me a tape. And, you know, these tapers they get, they trade tapes and from conferences and conventions and stuff. And so every month he would just send me a tape, you know. And I was active in AA down there, and I was a member of a group and everything. But, man, I cannot tell you how much I looked forward to getting those tapes every month. You know, I was just waiting. I'd be down at the post office, you know, every week looking for that tape to come. And I got tapes of people that, you know, some of the people that I consider giants in AA, you know, Clancy I and Bob O and Ken D, you know, and these are the things, man, it was, even though I was involved in AA down there, it was like a breath of fresh air. It was just, it recharged my batteries every time. So I really appreciate the tapers and the people that make that stuff available. I have a sobriety date. It's January 24th, 1989. For that, I am truly grateful. I don't deserve any of the credit for it. I did not come to AA and sign up for the 24-year plan. That was not what I was looking for. I was like, 6 months, and I'm out of here. I'm going to get my stuff together. Thank you very much, and I'll be on my way and be on with my life. You know, so I don't think I deserve any credit whatsoever for being here 24 years later. I had a good friend of mine just passed away, Paul C., great guy, died with a little over 40 years of sobriety and died sober. And I went to his service, and what a beautiful service. There was no officiating minister or clergy. His son got up and said a few words, and they sang one hymn. And the next hour and a half was just people getting up and talking about Paul and what he'd meant to them and what he'd done in their lives. And person, and probably 20 people got up and spoke, and 18 of those people were from Alcoholics Anonymous. And were people that he helped, everyone from who had 1 month to 20-some years, you know, that Paul had helped out. And Paul was a great guy and a good friend of mine. I remember when Paul celebrated 25 years, and I had like six at the time or something like that. And we went out to ice cream afterwards, and I just looked at him and said, Paul, I can't believe, you know, 25 years. I can't believe, you know, I just can't even fathom being sober for 25 years. And I guess it's not that special. He goes, I'm just good at procrastination. I've just been putting off my next drink one day at a time for the past 25 years, you know. Or, you know, how you get to be an old-timer? Don't drink and don't die. That's how you get to be an old-timer. So, not all that impressive. But I am truly grateful and infinitely glad that I'm here and I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this was, to me, this was punishment. You know, this was, I've had my fun, even though it wasn't fun anymore. I've had my fun, and now I got to take my medicine, and that's what AA was to me, and it's turned out to be anything but that. You know, I got to be honest with you. I don't do punishment well. I really don't, and I definitely don't do it for 24 years, you know? And if this thing was about hanging on one day at a time, y'all would have another speaker tonight, because the longest that I ever hung on for was a month. That's as long as I could hang on without a drink for before I got here and met you guys. I also have a home group. It's Hope Is Here in Old Town Alexandria, Tuesday nights at 8:30 standard drunk time. It's a, you know, it's a, at least in Northern Virginia it is. It's a closed meeting. If you're an alcoholic, got a problem with booze, you're welcome anytime. It's open on anniversaries. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other men, and I tell you these things because these things are the cornerstones of my recovery. You know, these are the things that keep me grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got a sponsor because I am not to be trusted to rely on my own judgment. I'm really not. I still have a sponsor because he saves me from my good ideas. I mean, I know none of you are like this, but I've never had an idea and gone, wow, that's a bad idea. We really shouldn't do that. I mean, I get an idea, and it's like, let's go. We need to do this right now, you know. But I have smart sponsors. They don't try to talk me out of anything. I call them and I tell them my good ideas, and they say, my sponsor's smart. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, why don't we just talk about that next week? Let's just put that on the shelf. Let's talk about that next week. Well, he already knows by the time next week rolls around, I've had 500 more good ideas, you know. So he says, well, what about that thing? Oh, that's old news. That's history. We got to talk about this, you know. And then I got to put that one on the shelf for a week, you know. And he just saves me from my good ideas. I've done the GSR thing, and I've got some people that I sponsor that are getting involved in service, and they get very frustrated with, you know, we can't get anything done in Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes forever to get anything done in this service structure. Oh my God, and we got to vote on this and have conference, everything, you know. I said, I don't know. I don't know, but I think it might have kind of been designed that way, you know, because I know me, and I know I get these brilliant ideas, and they might not turn out to be so brilliant, but when I get them, I think that's what we got to do, you know, and let's get hopping, you know, and maybe things don't move so fast in the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous so that we can catch up with ourselves. You know, we can catch up with our sponsors. The principles of Alcoholics Anonymous can work in the midst of all our good ideas. It was Bill Wilson that said that the good is the enemy of the best, you know. And I've always had those good intentions, always, always had those good intentions in everything I've ever done. And a lot of those things that I did based on those good intentions wound up on a thing here we call a four step, you know. And a lot of those things I had to make amends for, you know. So a sponsor helped save me from my good ideas. And I love the people that I sponsor, you know, because they keep me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous because you know what? They just won't leave you alone. They just keep coming at you, you know. I've been through so many experiences in AA and not all of them were good. And in the hardest times that I've gone through in sobriety, you know, these guys are still calling me. I mean, I was going through a divorce and I literally had one guy. They would call me and go, blah, 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 this is going on. And I go, oh, yeah? You want to hear about something going on? I'll tell you about something going on. This is what's going on with me. And he would literally say, I really feel for you, Dave, but we were talking about me. Now, blah, 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 blah. Okay, what do you got? All right, yeah, tell me about it. You know? They keep me in the middle of AA. I always think booze deserves an honorable mention in a meeting of AA. I'm, you know, the age-old question, why am I an alcoholic? I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I just know this. I love booze. I love booze. From the first time I got drunk, and I grew up in a household that didn't have alcohol in it. I don't remember any preaching against alcohol or the evils of alcohol or anything like that. It just wasn't there. You know, you came to our house, it was coffee, milk, tea, or water. You know, that's what you got to drink. And I got my first real drink. I had a, you know, sips off of my brother's beer and a Scotch whiskey, and it tasted bad, and it burned when it went down. But when I really got enough of that stuff in me, I was about 15 years old, and I went over to my buddy Mike's house, and he mixed up Bacardi 151 and Country Time lemonade mix in a Tupperware bowl, and we started passing that thing around and drinking. How to get the job done, yeah. And I got enough of that stuff in me that I knew release from care, boredom, and worry the first time in my life, you know. It was all that. I didn't even know that I felt bad until I felt that good, you know. But I'm feeling this going, wow, it was really bad because this is how it should be, you know. You'll hear it described in a million different ways, you know. I felt different. I didn't fit in. I was scared. I had anxiety. You'll hear it described in a million different ways. The only way I can describe it is, you know, I had two loving parents. I had everything I ever needed. I had almost everything I ever wanted, except for one thing, which has always eluded me, and that's more, you know, or enough, you know. Never quite found that one. You know, but I had these loving parents, and I had everything I needed and almost everything I ever wanted. But it always just seemed to me like I just knew there was some place I was supposed to be. There was something I was supposed to be doing, and there was somebody I was supposed to be doing it with. And the only thing I was really sure of was I wasn't in the right place, and I wasn't doing the right thing, and I wasn't doing it with the right people, you know. And I didn't know where that was, you know. Y'all seemed to know. Y'all seem to just be comfortable with whatever you were doing, wherever you're doing it, whatever. I mean, not like 100% of the time, but the grand majority of the time, you guys seem to be comfortable that you were in the right place and you were doing what you were supposed to be doing and things were working right. And I was just sure that it wasn't. And I don't know why. And nobody gave that to me. I don't believe anybody taught that to me. I just had it, you know. And I got enough of that Bacardi 151 in me, and that all went away. That all went away. And I was at peace. For one of the first times I can remember where I was, who I was, and who I was with, you know. Nothing dramatic happened that night. The cops didn't show up. The SWAT team didn't kick the door in. I don't think I even got sick that night, after that night. But one thing I know did happen that night. What happened was something got stamped on my brain. And what got stamped on my brain was this works. Booze works. It got branded on my brain. And guess what? A brand never comes out. I'm an alcoholic, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And that brand, until the day that I die, if I stay sober 5,433 years, that brand will still be on my brain. The booze works, even though it doesn't work. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking. That is my great obsession as an alcoholic, see? I didn't know that at the time, though, you know? When I was a kid, I was involved in the church. We went to the Southern Baptist Church. Any Southern Baptists here? All right, excellent. What? Maybe I shouldn't talk. Oh, yeah, I will. Why don't Southern Baptists do it standing up? They're afraid somebody might think they're dancing. Oh, yeah, they get it. Anyway, I was youth church, youth council, youth choir, youth drama. I was all this stuff. I was baptized at the age of 11, and I had... And it wasn't all fake. I had a relationship with a God of my understanding. And I believe that what happened was when I took a drink, when I got enough of that stuff in me, I got a new God. I got a new God. If you wanted to find a God as something that you worship and you're willing to go to any lengths for and do anything for and want more than anything to have a relationship with that thing, then alcohol became my God. You know, it replaced it just like that. I didn't realize that. I didn't understand that. But that's exactly what happened. And I drank as often and as much as I could. Everybody believes that they're the worst kind of alcoholic. You know, I know I do. You know, I can tell you why I think. The big book says, if when you want to quit drinking, you can't. Or if when you drink, you have little or no control over the amount you drink, you're probably alcoholic. And I'm case number two. I'm not a guy who didn't drink a fifth a day for 50 years and then have to come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I had cirrhosis of the liver. That wasn't my story. I drank as often, and I drank as much as I could. And I was a periodic. I was that guy that would get in trouble, you know, get people upset with me, and then quit for a day or a week or a month. And then I would drink again, you know. And I think I'm the worst alcoholic because I'm the guy that will give the people who love me, I will stay sober just long enough to give the people who love me hope. You know, just long enough to give him hope. Maybe this time he means it. Maybe this time he's serious. Maybe this time he's going to do it. And then I drank again, you know. And I didn't understand why. My mother, after I was sober a couple of years, my poor mother, she's not an alcoholic. She's not built for it. I've seen her drink like twice in her entire life. And wonderful woman. But she asked me after I was sober a couple of years, she said, you got sober, but you know, before this whole AA thing, you got sober a couple of times. And I said, yeah, you know, actually more than a couple of times. And she said, well, why couldn't you just stay sober? And I said, you want to know what it was like quitting drinking? And she said, yeah. I said, hold your breath. She went, oh. I said, now hold it for a month. That's what it was like. That's what quitting drinking was like, you know. I had a lot of fun with booze, I got to admit. I had a lot of fun. At the beginning, it was fun. It was good times. It was going places you're not supposed to go, doing things you're not supposed to do. It was adventure. It was excitement. It was wonderful. Once upon a time, you know. And then things began to pile up on me. I began to say things. I began to do things. I began to get in trouble. People began to get upset. And as those things began to pile up on me, I drank to not feel bad. And booze worked really, really well. It made me not feel bad. And the end of my heaviest drink and the very best I could get out of the bottle was absolutely nothing. The very best I could get out of the bottle was what we call oblivion. You don't think, you don't feel, you don't exist. And by the time I got there, and it was a short ride for me, by the time I got there, I was fine with that. I was fine with that, you know. Lots of, you know, because everybody who talked to me about my drinking, some of them were trying to help me. Some of them were just sick of me. Some of them really loved me. But everybody who talked to me about my drinking told me, if you just quit drinking, everything will be okay. I'm here to tell you, I quit drinking. Everything was not okay. Everybody was happy about me quitting drinking, except me. Yeah, y'all might have done this before. Sound familiar? Two things about my drinking. One was, we got this cute little saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, one is too many and a thousand is never enough. And I truly did not understand this when I got here, that I have a physical allergy to alcohol. That means when I put alcohol in my system, and it does not matter why or who gave it to me or what for or how many I meant to have or what I got to do afterwards or what happened last time or what's going to happen this time, it doesn't matter. When I put booze in my body goes, there's something in my body goes, boom, like that. And I'm going to have another, and I'm going to have another, and I'm going to have another, and I'm going to have another. And I did not understand that. I didn't understand why. One of the times that my family confronted me about my drinking, I ran home and to patch things up, and I told them, yeah, I got mixed up with the wrong people. You know, it's all different this time. It was always going to be different, trust me. It's always going to be different. And it's going to be different now. And I really, out of the hundreds of times that I said that, 99 out of 100, I just wanted to get you off my back, all right? That time, I actually meant it. I had so much to live for. I had so much potential. Yeah. My sponsor explained to me what potential is. It means ain't done jack yet. That's what potential is. But I had all this potential, right? So I really meant it. So I was so sincere in this that I lasted 2 days. And I lasted 2 days because 2 days later I went out with my buddies and they were all drinking and I wasn't. And they said, you don't look like you're having any fun, Dave. And I wasn't having any fun because they were all drinking and I wasn't. And they said, why don't you just have a beer with us? That's a perfectly, sounds like a perfectly reasonable solution to me. You know, so I had a beer. You know, 20 minutes later I was in the back shotgunning beers and doing the things that we were doing and somebody drunker than I was driving, you know. And I woke up the next morning with my daily morning prayer that I had back then, which was, oh, you know, I did it again. Followed by the most famous words, oh well, you know, I didn't understand that. I really didn't understand. I can't tell you how many times I went to have a drink, one beer, and I wound up missing whatever the important date was, the important thing that I had to do the next day, whatever promises I had made. Something happens inside of me once I take a drink, and I did not understand that. The other part is this obsession, and I didn't understand why I couldn't stay sober. You know, quitting was not my problem. I quit hundreds of times, thousands of times. Staying quit presents a different challenge for me. You know, if it wasn't for that staying quit thing, we'd have a lot more members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that staying quit thing was tricky for me. And I never understood why I couldn't stay quit once I quit. Well, this is the best way I've heard it described. I heard this guy talking about alcoholism, you know, all kinds of degrees and everything. And I never went to treatment, so I didn't have the benefit of all this information that he was going over, so it was very intriguing to me. But he said that there's background noise in everybody's head. And the background noise in a normal person's head is like this. And the background noise in an alcoholic's head is like this. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that thing is going, you know. I know this never happens to you, you know, but I got this thing going. We should have said this, and we should have said that, and why didn't we do this, and why didn't we do that, and let's do this, and let's do that, and let's do this, and next time we'll do this, next time we'll do that, and I'm going, oh, my God, you know. And here's the truth. The truth is I would stay sober as long as I could stand it. And when I couldn't stand it no more, I had to have a break. I had to have a break, you know. I had to have that peace. You know what booze did for me? Just turned off the volume in my head. Turned off all that noise, all that screaming. It quieted all the snakes squirming around in my belly. And I felt okay. And you know what? It doesn't do that for everybody. But it does that for me. Because I'm an alcoholic. See? I would stay sober as long as I could stand it. Ironically, you know what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me? It turns off the noise in my head. It quiets all those snakes squirming around in my belly. I mean, it lets me know the same kind of peace that I found out of that bottle that I couldn't find at the end. Once upon a time, I should say, I found out of that bottle. It gives me the same degree and more of a sense of peace and ease and comfort that I was always looking for, you know. It's, but, you know, in order to get it out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to do something. And I promise this is the only curse word I'll use tonight, the entire time I talk. But what I got to do to get that out of Alcoholics Anonymous is I got to do work. You know? And I don't like that because I'm an alcoholic, you know. I want to negotiate. I want to, you know, I want to manipulate. I want to get what I'm getting out of you because the rest is negotiable after I get what I want, you know, and you just, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's based on spiritual principles, you know, and you can't negotiate with them any more than you can negotiate with gravity. You know, you can't manipulate them any more than you can manipulate gravity. They just do what they do, you know. It's the way the universe works, and it's the way spiritual principles work, and I have to put in the work to get the results here, you know. But, oh boy, what results they are. So, what happened? What happened was I got in a little bit of trouble, and I was a tough guy, so I did what tough guys do when they get into trouble. I ran home to Mom, which is what we do, and Mom got a lawyer, and the lawyer took care of the legal issues, and they said, we know a couple who's sober a year in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said they'd be willing to talk to you if you wanted to talk to them, and since yes seemed to be the right answer, since they were paying for the lawyer, I said yes, and I went and met John and Lisa, who are both still sober today. And they were both a year sober, and I sat down with John. John got there first. He's the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever met. And my first impression of a member of AA is he's smoking unfiltered Camel cigarettes and drinking black coffee, and I thought, oh my God, this guy's getting well. Wow. So, yeah, we are. I wasn't judgmental at all. So we sat down, and John, something different happened that day. Everybody who had ever talked to me about my drinking wanted to talk about my problem. Dave, you got a problem. Dave, you need to do something about your problem. Dave, when are you going to do something about your drinking? And the only problem with that was, if you had a problem with my drinking, you had a problem. Not me. You got a problem, you got a problem. Just leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. I ain't hurting nobody but me, right? Yeah, I got disabused of that delusion a long time ago. But that was my reaction. I'm an alcoholic. I know none of you are like this. But you tell me, still today, you tell me you have to do this.
Yeah.
My immediate gut reaction is, oh, yeah? We'll see about that, you know? The house that I grew up in, that my mother sold some years ago, there's a porch on the front of that house. That whole house, there could be an earthquake and a hole could open up in the ground and swallow that house, and that porch will still be there, I swear. But that porch is on that house because my mother said the magic words. She said, I'd like a porch on the front of the house. I said, I'll build you a porch. And she said the magic words, oh, you can't do that. Stand back. You know? Don't tell an alcoholic they can't do anything. But John sat down and something different happened that day. John didn't want to talk about my problem. He didn't tell me I was an alcoholic. He told me he was an alcoholic. And he told me why he was an alcoholic. And what happened that day was he took away my last best excuse. Because my last best excuse, if you really corner me, my last best excuse always is, you just don't know how it is. You don't understand. You know? And actually, all those well-meaning non-alcoholics that were talking to me about my problem, I didn't know how right I was. Because if you're not an alcoholic, you don't know what it's like to be an alcoholic. And if you don't know what it's like to be an alcoholic, I pray and hope that you never do know what it's like to be an alcoholic. Because it ain't any fun getting one of these seats in here. At least I haven't met anybody who came in here because they were having so much fun. But he didn't try to tell me I was an alcoholic. He told me he was an alcoholic. And the problem was he took away my last best excuse because not only, you know, I didn't need to say it. Of course, I wasn't going to admit it to him, but it was pretty obvious. He knew exactly what it was like to be me. And not only had he walked in my shoes, he'd gone a few miles further down the road. And at the end of that, he asked me three questions. He said, so I hear you got a drinking problem. And I said, yeah, I like to have a beer every once in a while, you know. He said, I hear you got a problem with drugs. I said, yeah, I'll smoke a J every once in a while, you know. He said, tell me this, are you happy? You don't look happy. And I said, no. I don't even know what happiness is. They took me to some meetings. You know what I remember about my first meetings of AA? The laughter. Because I realized it had been a long time since I'd really laughed. I mean, not like the, when you're loaded and everybody's laughing and you got the giggles, or when your boss tells a joke and you're supposed to laugh. And I mean, really laughed, you know? And they took me to some meetings, but I wasn't sold yet. I could easily admit that I had a few problems. I had a lot of extracurricular activities that went along for an alcoholic of my type. And I could easily admit I had a problem with those, but I'm not an alcoholic. See, I had a problem with definitions when I got here. You said, do you think you're an alcoholic? And what you meant was, do you think you suffer from a spiritual malady that's coupled with a physical allergy to alcohol and an obsession, mental obsession, whereby you can't stop thinking about it and it gets you every time when you drink it? That's what you meant. What I meant when I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic, is I don't live in a box and drink out of a brown paper bag. That's what I meant, because to me, that's what an alcoholic was. See? Luckily for me, I was wrong, because they didn't have a solution for just generally messed up kids. They had a solution for alcoholics. It's much easier to have a solution when you have the problem that everybody has. But I went to a lot of meetings, and I did what in my group we affectionately refer to as auditing the course, which means that, yes, it's a good idea to come to AA. This is a really great thing for you guys. And you got a lot of good information, but you don't really need to be here if you're not really an alcoholic, you know? I mean, this is just like, I'm just doing this for like extra credit or something, you know? And I did that for a little while. I went back to school in Charlottesville, and then I've never tapered off of drinking. I've always tapered on. So I was tapering on again, and in very short order, I was drinking the same amount that I was drinking before. And that day, January 24th, I came home. I popped open a beer. I drank half of it in one gulp. And it was not a voice, but it was a thought so loud and so clear, I knew exactly what it said. It said, there's nothing different. Because the only hope for a drinking drunk like me is this time it's going to be different. This winter it's going to be different. This summer it's going to be different. When I get home, it's going to be different. When I get back to school, it's going to be different. When I get her, it's going to be different. When I get rid of her, it's going to be different. It's always somehow, some way, I'm going to figure out, like, the magic formula, you know, and get all the pieces set right, you know, so that I'll be okay, you know. And this thought occurred to me, and it said, there's nothing different. And, you know, for once, as we call these, it was just a moment of grace, you know, where I just saw clearly that I was going back down the same road that I just came from. And for once in my life, I didn't want to take the trip. And that was my last, I didn't know that was going to be my last drink. My last drink was half a can of Coors. As a matter of fact, I was 12-stepping a guy that had been in and out of our group for a little while. This was a few years ago. He'd been in and out for a little while, and he called me, and I left work, and I went over, and he was drinking Coronas, and he was living with his brother and drinking Coronas, and I talked to him for a little while, and then I said, you know, it's time for the meeting. What do you want to do, man? You want to give it a try or not? And he said, sure. I said, good, finish your beer, and we'll go to the meeting. And he said, why? I said, because I never got to finish mine, and I wouldn't want to do that to you. Now finish your beer, and we'll go to the meeting. What you call using your darkest past to help others. So I didn't know what to do. I just did. I poured the rest of that beer down the sink. I went on about my business. An hour later, I was walking down the street, and I ran into a guy that I had partied with the year before. And in the middle of the year, he had disappeared. And if you ran with the crowd that I ran with and you disappeared, it only meant one of three things. Either you went to jail, you went to treatment, or you were dead. And if he was dead or went to jail, I would have known about it. Nobody knew what happened to this guy. So I did a quick deduction. I grabbed him by the arm as he was passing me by, and I said, Philip, it's Dave. And he said, oh, hi, Dave. And I said, are you in AA? And he said, yeah, I'm in AA. And I said, will you take me to a meeting? And he said, yeah, I'll take you to a meeting today. Dave, I'll take you to a meeting tonight. I'll pick you up at 7:30. Where do you live? Give me your address. And I gave him my address and my phone number. Ironically enough, he did not give me his phone number. That became very important because that was about 1:30 in the afternoon, and he said he'd pick me up at 7:30. And that's amazing what the alcoholic mind can do with 6 hours, because at 1:30 in the afternoon, I was just scared enough to ask someone to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By 7:30 that evening, I had figured out that I had grossly overreacted to the situation. And it was not that bad. Like, I swear to this day, if I had had his number, I would have called him and told him anything. I would have told him, I got to do my homework, I got to walk the dog, I got to paint my toenails. I don't care. I would have said anything to get out of going to that meeting, but I didn't have his number. He picked me up and he took me to what I call my first meeting of AA. It was Monday night JPA in Charlottesville, Virginia, and three things happened. Number one was I got a white chip, and I got a white chip or surrender chip, whatever they call it these days. They're silver now. They used to be white poker chip. with a double A in the middle. And I got it because they called for the white chip, and Philip went like this and gave me the elbow, so I got up and got one. And I don't know that if that night they were just like bored or feeling particularly generous, but they asked me if I wanted to say something when I picked up my white chip. And Randy's not here tonight, but it is Randy. Randy's not here because Randy will confirm. Randy was sober in Charlottesville when I got sober. I love to keep people around me, knew me at my best. And she and Chris L, they can totally confirm this. But when I picked up my white chip, I got it. What I said was, I am not an alcoholic. This is purely a precautionary measure, just in case. And they said, keep coming back, you know, in that smarmy AA way, you know, that they do things. And so I got that white chip, and after the meeting, Philip said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. He said, you see that guy over there? I said, yeah. He said, go ask him to be your sponsor. And I kind of knew, because John and Lisa, I kind of knew what the sponsor thing was, so I went up to Jim. And I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. He said, do you have a big book? And I said, no. He said, do you have $5? I said, no. I lied, of course, because I didn't want to put any money into this thing. I'm only going to be here for 6 months, right? So he bought me my first big book, and he gave me rides to meetings for the first week, you know. And then I said, I can make my own way. And for the first 30 days I went to meetings, I don't know how many I went to. I don't know how often I went to them. I went to them, but because I wasn't counting, because this was going to be easy. I mean, I quit all this other stuff, and I'm not an alcoholic, so quitting booze is going to be really easy. I mean, I got this, no problem. So I wasn't paying attention to how many meetings I go to. I wasn't paying attention to anything. I was doing the newcomer dance. I was counting the holes in the ceilings, 5 strips of the coffee pot, 3 cigarette breaks, figure out which girl I wanted to talk to afterwards. I mean, do anything but pay attention to what's going on, because you don't really need to pay attention if you're not really an alcoholic. So I went on like this for 30 days, and after 30 days, I went and I picked up my 30-day chip. It's a blue poker chip with a double A in the middle. And I'll never forget, Big Tom H comes up and gives me a hug and says, congratulations on your 30 days. And I looked at him straight in the eye and I said, I'm going to drink, which was news to me. And if I had known that, I certainly wouldn't have told him. But for some reason, those are the words that came out of my mouth. And all of a sudden, I knew it. Because I'll tell you what, I was bad at a lot of things when I was drinking. But I was really, really good at two things. One was just barely getting by. I mean, just barely getting by, like leaving a little skin behind, but making it, kind of getting by, you know, getting out of the jam. And I was a champion plan comer-upper with her. I mean, you stick me in a jam and feed me 2 beers, and I will figure it out. You know, I will figure out my way out of this box, you know. And I had a plan that night, again, my plans. I had a plan that night. My plan was to pick up the 30-day chip at the meeting and go meet the blonde at the keg party afterwards, you know. And I'm telling myself the whole time that I'm just going to drink Diet Coke or ginger ale or something. And all of a sudden, those words came out of my mouth, and I knew I was not going to drink Diet Coke or ginger ale. I mean, oh, my God. It had been 30 days since I had a drink. I was so dry, I was a fire hazard. I mean, I needed a drink bad. But I said those words to him, and I regretted it as soon as I said it, because I knew now I'm going to have to sit here and listen to every AA slogan ever invented. I'm going to have to sit here and listen to, don't leave before the miracle happens, and you can do it, and I thought I'd just puke on his shoes if he started quoting me the smarmy AA, you know, stuff. And he didn't say any of that. He looked me straight back in the eye, and he said, no, you're not. You're coming with us. I am not sure what step that is, but that's what he said. I do know what step that is now. In my group, we refer to that as the shut up and get in the car step, you know. But he said, no, you're not. You're coming with us. And I said, the smartest thing, up to and including tonight, the smartest thing I've ever said in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, okay, you know. My sponsor pointed out to me, just assume that everybody in here is an alcoholic. Or if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting in one of these chairs tonight, everybody in here knows how hard it is to get here. Everybody knows how hard it is to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that we are the fortunate few. You know what's harder than getting to Alcoholics Anonymous? Staying in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if it was easier to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous than it was to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, AA wouldn't have 3 million members. We'd have 30 million members. You know? I've been watching Revolving Door for a long, long time. But my sponsor gave me the key to staying in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it consists of one word. Okay. You know, I sponsor guys today. They call me. They ask me stuff. I tell them, this is what you do. And when I tell them this is what you do, there's a two-second pause before they say anything. I know what the two-second pause is. The two-second pause is, should I tell them to go jump off a bridge? Should I tell them to go jump off a bridge? Okay. I do things for twisted reasons sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just works for me. I realized a while ago that I can't prove my sponsor wrong unless I actually do what it is that he tells me to do. Now, if I don't do it and I complain about it, I'm just a whiner. If I do it and it doesn't work, I can go back to everybody and tell him how full of it he is and he doesn't know what he's talking about. So, like for the past 15 years, I have been in the constant pursuit of proving my sponsor wrong. And I haven't done so yet, but my life has improved dramatically in the process of trying to prove my sponsor wrong. So I don't know. It's a little twisted, but I go with it. It works for me, right? So I said, okay. And instead of going to the party and meeting this girl, I went out with them, and we went and got some pizza, and we rented some movies, and one of them dropped me off at home, and I went to bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I was still sober. And I just told you the story of my recovery in AA. Because I didn't realize then, but it was only a long time later that I realized what happened that night. What happened that night was I set my plan, my idea, my plan aside, and I took direction from another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed sober when I was absolutely sure that I was going to get drunk. And that's been the story of my recovery in AA. And the only thing that's ever stood in the way of my growth in Alcoholics Anonymous is what I think I know. That's the only thing that's ever stood in my way. See? And I learned the magic word. It's okay. I also learned the most deadliest words. It's, yeah, but. I actually said that to my sponsor a couple of years ago. We were talking, and I said, yeah, but, and I went on, and then I stopped about 10 seconds into it, and I said, did I say yeah, but? And he said, yeah, you did. I said, okay, I'm going to go pray. I'll call you later. So, now is the time in my story when I'm supposed to say, and then I sat down with that sponsor, and we opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we did the 12 steps, and I had a spiritual awakening, but... I know none of you are like this, but when I was out there drinking and somebody said, here, Dave, drink this. I went, okay. They said, here, smoke this. I said, okay. They said, here, take a couple of these. I said, okay. What do those do to you? You know? I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys said, get a sponsor, get a home group, do the steps. And I went, whoa. Whoa. Get up all in my business, you know? I just don't want to make any rash decisions, you know. I gotta, like, check this thing out first, you know, which is weird because, like, rash decisions are the only kind of decisions I've ever made in my life. But now I'm going to err on the side of caution. What I found out over the next 3 years of going to a lot of meetings and a lot of pool parties, a lot of all-night hard games, which are all good stuff. They're all fun and they're all fellowship. And what I found out from a lot of this was that I didn't suffer from alcohol. I suffered from something much more insidious than that. I suffered from something called alcoholism. See? And my sponsor tells me the difference. He said, Dave, what's the difference between a person who has a drinking problem and a person that's an alcoholic? And I said, what's that, Tom? He said, when a person has a drinking problem, quits drinking, the problem goes away. When an alcoholic quits drinking, the problem doesn't go away. And I was just 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was suffering greatly from the problem. I mean, I tried all kinds of things, you know. I came in, I took up every sport known to man, including high li. You know, excluding high li. I practiced my tennis serve an hour a day, became an ace racquetball player. I joined the rugby team. I lifted. I ran 5 miles a day. I mean, it was just Olympic shape. And I was crazy. I mean, I was the guy who'd go to AA pool parties and start fights, you know. And that's not a lie. I did that. You know, and the he-ing and the she-ing and the drama, oh my God, the drama, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just crazy. I was just me running rampant without alcohol through AA, you know. And I found the people like me, and we all ran rampant together, you know. And I didn't take a drink, but boy, I was a handful. I'll tell you what, the best way I can describe it is, ladies, I was the one that your sponsor pointed at and said, stay away from him. Don't go near him. That was me. I thought, it's a spiritual program, right? So I'm going to get, I got a 12-step Bible, and I got a bunch of deep books like I Am Now by Martin Buber and Iron John, and I'd read stuff, and I could come, and I could talk about God. I could lay some heavy spiritual stuff on you, some wow stuff, you know? And I'd leave the meeting, I'd go get in the car, and I'd just die because I was so lonely. I wanted to die. And I couldn't look myself in the eye in the mirror. And I was trying to cure myself, and I failed miserably. And I was 3 years sober, and I was living in Richmond. And I went to a 5:30 commuters meeting, and there was a guy there. A lot of things happened during that time. But, you know, basically where I was after 3 years was in my brilliance, I had figured out what AA is. AA is we've all escaped the alcohol monster, and we're going to sit around the AA campfire and roast marshmallows and play games and have fun. You better have as much fun as you can, because sooner or later, alcohol is going to reach over the fence and boom, get you. And if you're lucky, if you're really, really lucky, then you get back. You know? That, in my brilliance of going to meetings, lots of meetings, for 3 years I'd figured out what this is, and I was sitting around AA waiting for my number to come up, basically. And a guy showed up at this meeting, and to best of my knowledge, he'd never been there before. Best of my knowledge, he's never been back since, but he was there that day. And he talked about a solution. He was one of, he called himself a recovered alcoholic. One of those guys, you know. Oh, he's arrogant to call himself a recovered alcoholic. Actually, it's in the big book. He showed me where it is. He explained it to me a little bit later. He said, look, recovered doesn't mean cured. He says, if you get shot and you don't get killed, you're going to go to the hospital. The doctor's going to pull the bullet out. He's going to stitch you up. About 3 or 4 days later, he's going to come in. He's going to declare you a recovered gunshot victim. He said, but you ain't bulletproof. Next time you get shot, it's going to hurt. You know, so recovered is not cured. But there is such a thing as recovered. And I guess the thing that sold me more than anything about this guy was you could look in this guy's eyes, and I mean, he was drinking the Kool-Aid that he was selling. You know? I mean, he was buying. Whatever it was that he was trying to sell, he was buying it big time. And he was so convinced that he convinced me. Not really convinced me, but I was willing to give it a shot. Now, I'm a just enough kind of alcoholic. So I sidled up to him and said, you know, thinking about brushing up on the steps a little bit, you know. I'd been to so many 12 and 12 meetings, I thought I'd done the steps. I mean, I know none of you are like this, but I'm like that. Like, if I think about doing something 3 times, I've done it. It's done, right? So, thought about the steps for so long that I had actually done them in my own mind. So I sidled up to him and said, I was thinking about brushing up on the steps a little bit. And he said, so you want to do the steps? And I said, yeah, I guess you could say that. And he said, okay, meet me. Now I'll warn you, if you get one of these bleeding blue sponsors and you tell them you want to do the steps, they think you're serious. They think you mean it. They take you at your word. So he said, I want you to meet me Saturday at this meeting at this treatment center and bring a big book. And I went, and I was late, of course, and I met him. And I brought my big book, and we sat down at a picnic bench outside that treatment center. And in the first 2.5 hours, I'd taken steps 1, 2, and 3. I took the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 3 years without a drink after going to umpteen meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he showed me what an alcoholic is that I've described to you today. And at the end of that, I had absolutely no problem whatsoever, and I've never again questioned it, whether I'm an alcoholic of the garden variety, absolutely 100% bone deep, just like it describes in that book. And all I had to do was look at my drinking as compared to it as it is in that book. And we did the second step, and I was okay with the second step. You know, I grew up going to Southern Baptist Church. I mean, if you asked me to say the blessing at dinner, I'd ask you if you want the 20-minute or the 40-minute version. I can I and D and thou with the best of them. I'm like a royal ambassador, sword drills and everything, man. You know, we got to the chapter We Agnostics, and I said, we don't need to read this. I got the God thing. And he said, no, it doesn't say we agnostics. It doesn't say for those who think they're agnostics. It says we agnostics. I said, okay. So, you know, because if you argue with them, they go crazy. So I said, okay. So we read the chapter, you know, and we got to the how it works, you know, and we got to the A, B's, and C's and how it works. And he asked me 3 questions. He said, do you believe you're an alcoholic of the type described in this book? Without reservation, I could say yes. He said, do you believe that there's any human power, including yourself, can relieve your alcoholism? Since I had been trying for 3 years to relieve my alcoholism and I wound up sitting at a picnic bench with him, I could say, no, there's no human power to relieve my alcoholism. And he said, do you believe that God can and will if you ask him to? And I told him my first lie. I said, yes. And I told him yes because I've been around long enough to know that the right answer was yes. You know, but all those years that I didn't believe that I was really an alcoholic, not like you, you know what I really believed? I really believed that I was damaged goods. That if you took a knife and you slipped me from my Adam's apple to my belly button and opened me up, that you wouldn't find anything left inside except black, dead, dry rot. You know? That you know, oh yeah, God, do it for you. He'd do it for you. He'd do it for you. But you don't know me. You don't know where I've been. And you don't know what I've done. And you really don't want to know what goes on up here. And I'm not too sure God's interested in having somebody like that. But he saved me with the next question, because he said, are you willing to follow through with the program of action as it's outlined in this book and having absolutely no clue what I was in for? I said, yes. You know, and he sent me off that day to do my four-step. And my four-step took me 13 days and 20 hours of procrastination and 4 hours of writing. This is about how long it took me to get my four-step done. I started and it just went, pah, you know. And I called and said, you know, probably at like 11:30 at night on a Saturday, and said, I got it done. Let's do the fifth step. And he said, well, I'm going to be out of town, so we'll do it next week. Oh, God. So anyway, we did it the next week, and I read all those things. You know, because I learned things when I was out there. I learned, you know, you don't ever tell anybody the whole story. You know, I did learn that the lie goes down a lot easier if you mix just a little bit of the truth in it, but you don't ever tell anybody the whole story, you know, everything. Number two, you never write it down. I mean, that's called evidence, you know, so you don't do that. So everything I've done in AA that's helped me, I've done against my better judgment. But I don't know, still to this day, I cannot tell you, because I was that guy. I did not come with open-mindedness, willingness, and honesty. I came with spiritual and intellectual arrogance. And I came with belligerence. And I came with conceit. You know, that's what I showed up with to work with in AA. And I have no idea to this day why that guy, after so many, I was that guy. You could not tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to do. You're not going to make an AA robot out of me. I was that guy for years, and I have no idea why. When this guy sat down and he told me to do this stuff, I just did it. I just did it. And the only reason I can figure out why is because I ran out of answers. I ran out of answers, and I ran out of plans. That's what had to happen to me to get what you guys got. I had to run out of plans. I had to try all my better ideas, and when none of them worked, then I was ready to have what you guys had, right? And so I just did them. And I read that stuff to him, and we took that drive, driving in the car, me with the flashlight, him driving. I don't know about you guys, but I had a polite sponsor. You know, a polite sponsor is when you're telling him your deepest, darkest secrets, the worst things in the world, the things that you're going to carry to the grave, he turns his head when he yawns. Like, yeah, how many times? You know? I'm going to add this sponsor that told me, one sponsor I did an inventory with, he just looks at me and goes, is there a word in the dictionary for it? And I said, yeah. He said, then you weren't the first person to do it. He said, as a matter of fact, so many people did it, they had to make up a word for it, you know? So nothing unique, you know, about this alcoholic, just a regular alcoholic. And I started making amends, and I started kidnapping newcomers and trying to carry this message, and yeah, the people are laughing, know what I mean? And trying to carry this message. And, you know, the great thing is I woke up one day and I realized that I hadn't thought about drinking in a long, long time. It's just gone. I don't know when it went, and I don't know where it went, because God just took it away, and he didn't ask my permission, and he didn't send me a notice. He just took it away. That thing that plagued me for years, that ruled me, that was the centerpiece of my life in my mind, was gone. And in its place was a peace and an understanding. And I didn't even know what was happening to me. I was just taking action, and I was changing. As a result of sitting down and doing those steps, I will never be the same man again. I'm not the same man that walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But I will never be the same man again after going through that process, you know. And things got different, you know. And you know, then, shortly there, so I had this spiritual experience. And I was graduating school, and this was in 1992, middle of the recession, and I graduated with a civil engineering degree, and I couldn't pay somebody to give me a job, whereas I went into school in 87, they were like flying engineering graduates across the country, giving them signing bonuses. I graduated in 92, couldn't pay anybody to give me a job because it was the middle of the recession. And I've always liked the path of least resistance, right? So I went to a job fair, and there was like all these tables, all these companies, all these kids around them and everything. And there was one table in the corner with no line at it. So I went over to that one, and that one just happened to be the Peace Corps. So I wound up, you know, it's ironic because one of the reasons that I went to engineering school was because there was no foreign language requirement. Guess what I wound up doing when I graduated? Moving to a town of about 300 people in the middle of the Andes Mountains, 8,000 feet above sea level, where nobody spoke English, you know? And I found an AA group there. You know, and I was a member of Grupo Siempre Unidos de Latacunga, Ecuador. It was the town down the road, you know. And those guys, they were great. You know, it was about, know, 7 or 8 of us, and they met 6 nights a week, you know, and after a month, I could have told their story, they could have told my story. I mean, it was, you know, we all knew each other, but the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous started to happen. You know, they do coffee after the meeting. It's like a little social thing, 10 or 15 minutes after the meeting, and the first time. They all wanted to know, you know, because I was the new guy, you know, showing up to the meeting. They wanted to know about how the meetings were in America and the same 12 steps and how things are. And we're talking for about 10 minutes, and this 52-year-old man looks over at me and says, "Will you listen to my fist step?" And I said, "You know, I don't speak very good Spanish." And he said, "I know. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. But, you know," he said, "listen to my fist step." And I said, "Okay." And I said, "Yeah, okay, but, you know, we got to do the whole thing, you know." And I just did with him what my sponsor did with me. And I had to get an English big book and a Spanish big book. Because, you know, if you're going to sponsor somebody, you got to know all the big words, like anonimidad and serenidad, you know. You got to know what you're talking about, you know. And I just showed it to him when we went through the steps and he did the work, you know. And one of the greatest joys is, and this guy was like, you know, he was 3 years sober. Everybody in the group was 3 years sober. Because 3 years before, so one of the town drunks who had gotten sober in Mexico came back and carried the message to these guys who were his drinking buddies in this town. And then he went back to Mexico, and all these guys in the group were like 3 years sober. But this guy was like as serious as a heart attack. I mean, you know how we are. I mean, I think if he'd have smiled, his face would have broken. You know, I mean, just serious. And we're going through this process, and he goes through the fourth fifth step, and he starts making amends. And one day I'm walking, he was a taxi driver, and one day I'm walking through the plaza, and I'm all up in my head about, you know, blah, 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 you know, all this stuff that's going on. And I hear laughter, and I look up, and I look at the taxi stand, and there's Lucho, and he's with his taxi driver buddies, and he's got his head thrown back, and he's laughing. And I tell you what, I never drank, smoked, or snorted anything that made me feel like that. I got hooked immediately. In my group, what we call the juice. I love working with other alcoholics because you know what? I don't get people sober. I don't get people drunk. But when I help another alcoholic and I take them through that process, I get a seat on the 50-yard line to watch God happen to another human being. And that's a show that you do not want to miss. Better than the Super Bowl, baby. It's the best thing I've ever seen. And I did all that, and I came back to America, and it was boy meets girl on AA campus, and got married, and I got two beautiful children who are 14 and 16 now. My son was born on my 8th anniversary, you know, January 24th, 1997. And I think it's perfect, you know, because January 24th in my house is not Dave's anniversary, it's Will's birthday, you know, and I think that's perfect. You know, once again, it's not about me, it's about him. And, you know, it was good for a while. I'm trying to make this brief, but real active in AA, got this home group sponsoring people, got a good job. I had a good job. I had a house in the suburbs. I had two cars. One of them was a minivan. One of them was an SUV. I had a beautiful wife. I had two beautiful children, one boy, one girl, who played in the soccer league and, you know, had a tree house in the back. And I swear to God, I didn't realize it until I paid the guy for doing it. I had a white picket fence around the backyard. I mean, like, just the picture, you know. And then one day, you know, it wasn't like one day it happened. There was trouble in paradise. But eventually, my wife looked at me and said, "I want to get separated." And it was like within a span of 6 months, you know, this picture perfect thing on the outside came completely unglued, and my life completely changed. You know, what I found out was when I went through that process with a sponsor and I did those steps, it was such an incredible, revolutionary change. I thought, I got it. I got it. And every time I think I got it, I am about to get smacked by life, you know. And I found out through the ups and downs of sobriety that there is no destination. Every once in a while, I get like the last time was Rich. Rich calls me up and goes, "I need to talk to you." And I go, "Okay, let's go get coffee." And he says, "You know, everything's great. You know, wife is great. Job's great. Everything's great. Except I'm not growing fast enough." And I said the same thing to him. My sponsor said to me, "Why? Where are you going?" I don't know. You know, I felt the same way. Like, I should be growing faster. Why? Where am I going? There's no place to get to. It's all in the journey. The whole thing is the journey, you know. And there's ups and there's downs along the journey. Alcoholics Anonymous has carried me through the downs, and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have carried me through the downs, you know. And there's been more ups than there's been downs, but there's been some downs, you know. And I had this period where for 6 months, my whole life came unglued, you know. And my mantra for the 6 months was, don't lose the job, don't drink. Don't lose the job, don't drink. And everything else was just a complete mess, you know, going on. Some of the people in my group heard me at the most unspiritual during that time, you know. I had one, Mike called me and go, Dave, maybe you're going through this so that everybody can watch you, you know, you can be an example to everybody else to how to walk through this. And I said, why do I have to be the example? I don't want to be the example. Why can't I just be one of the observers for once? Why do it have to be me? Yeah, but I lived through that, and everybody came to the other side, you know, and my kids are doing great, and she's doing great, and everybody's happy once again, you know. And I've had multiple jobs of my own choosing, you know, like without having to leave before they caught me and stuff like that, you know. And I've had ups and downs at that, but the greatest thing that I've gotten is I've gotten this relationship with this God who I really don't understand, you know. What I found out was all I had to do was give God a chance, and God showed up in my life. The big book says he'll meet me wherever I can start. And I wasn't real sure because, you know, I grew up going to Southern Baptist. You know, it's a part about we came to believe that a God could restore us to sanity. You know, what I heard when I read that was we came to believe, because I grew up going to the Southern Baptist Church. And Southern Baptist Church, you don't believe stuff. You believe stuff. You know what I mean? And that's like different somehow, you know. And I did not believe that he was going to do this, but I found out I didn't have to. And all I had to do was give him a shot. All I had to do was show up and do the work. All I had to do was show up and do the work, and God showed up in my life, you know. And I've been able to share that with my children. My children know how to do an inventory and know how to do a 10-step at the end of the day. They don't know that's what they're doing, but they know how to do it. They don't do it very often anymore because they're 14 and 16, but they know how to do it because I've done that with them. You know, this is the bottom line. The bottom line is I thought I was damaged goods. I thought I was too bad for God, you know, and being a parent now has taught me a couple of things. I have a relative assurance that my kids love me, and I can say that because they tell me they love me, and I get a present at Christmas, and it's not Old Spice. So, you know, with teenagers, that's about as good as you get. And I have a reasonable assurance that they love me. You know why my kids love me? They don't love me because I get asked to come speak in Madison, Virginia. They don't care what I do for a living. I used to say they don't care how much I make, but, you know, they're teenagers now. They don't care how many years they've never seen me drink. They don't care how long I've been sober. They don't care what my home group is. They don't care how many people I sponsor. They don't care about any of that stuff. You know why they love me? They love me because I'm their dad. You know why my God loves me? Because I'm his kid. Period. End of story. You know, one of my favorite sayings is my friend Bill M. from Pennsylvania says, God doesn't care whether I'm drunk or sober. God just cares. Period. You know, I love my kids no matter what. If they broke my heart, if they cut my heart out and cut it into 1,000 pieces and stomped it into the ground, I would still love them. Do I get upset with them sometimes? Yeah. Do they get on my nerves sometimes? Yeah. Do I love them? Absolutely. Unconditionally. And it just doesn't make sense to me that I'm a better dad than God. God loves me no matter what. See? And all my life, I've been trying to earn something that's given to me. You know? I've been trying to earn God's love. And you can't earn it. It's already given. And it's already here. You know? And everything I have my entire life today, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. To breaking through a little bit of my hard-headedness, becoming willing to take some actions, becoming willing to ask for some help, and my life's become something that I never could have envisioned. Thanks again for asking me to come to speak.